My name is Jeff Lerner, and I interview elite performers from a wide range of disciplines, entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, scientists, artists, and more. This is Unlock Your Potential. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Unlock Your Potential. This is your host, Jeff Lerner. So excited to be back having amazing conversations with amazing human beings. As per usual, we're joined by another one. The world is so just resplendently filled with wonderful humans, and I'm grateful that they come on our show and we get to talk. Today, our wonderful human is Dr. Stan Tatkin, a best-selling author, therapist, researcher, and co-founder of the PACT Institute. He's the developer of a psychobiological approach to couples therapy. All the listeners know that relationships and really proactive growth and development through the context of relationships is a big passion of mine. And so I'm excited to talk about that. He's also an assistant clinical professor at the UCLA David Geffen School of Medicine, Department of Family Medicine. And he and his wife, Tracy, actually created the PACT Institute to train mental health professionals to think and work through a psychobiological lens in their clinical practice. He's an author. He's got lots of books, super smart. And even more than smart, he uses his smarts to actually make the world a better place. Dr. Tatkin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Jeff. It's wonderful.
Not all smart people use their smarts for good, you know.
I guess that's true. Yes. I decided not to do it for evil.
We appreciate that. I'm struggling to contain my joie de vivre here because this is so one of my favorite things to get into. Well, as I framed, so let's start maybe with something that might have jumped out to listeners in the opening here, which is psychobiology. Right. Can you sort of double click on that term for us? It seems like it's going to be an anchor here for the combo.
It's basically study of the mind and body, but it's also infant brain development and development and neurodevelopment throughout the lifespan. So we study everything about the human being development from infancy, actually prenatal, through the lifespan, but also the autonomic nervous system, getting very nerdy here, I guess. And then also we watch people, observe them through digital frame analysis, bit by bit, frame by frame. So we actually study people in and under stress in front of us. And so that's the other part of it as well.
So you referenced the autonomic nervous system. So for the audience, we're talking sympathetic and parasympathetic, the so-called fight or flight and rest and digest.
Right.
Which it might be like, well, why, how is that actually germane to relationships? I would offer up that like that is actually the essence of relationships. Relationships, you tell me if I'm wrong, but like understanding the self at the level of emotional neurological reactivity is actually how you get into the core of a relationship, because relationships are, or let's call them serious or intimate relationships, are basically by definition those relationships that we allow to function at that level because we let go of the superficial and social controls that we're usually imposing on ourselves in less serious relationships. Am I summing that up?
Yeah, and I think that's correct. I'd even go even more basic than that. During COVID, when I wrote In Each Other's Care, I started really shifting my thinking to all human primates. What makes us difficult animals to be in relationship with? And that is all across the world, throughout time, since the beginning of our species, what makes us very difficult? And there are certain things that have nothing to do with psychology, nothing to do with personality or gender or sex or where you're from, or if you're male or female, tall or short, doesn't matter. We're in many ways very difficult to be in relationship with over the long term because we have a really acute survival instinct. And our brain tends to be built a little bit more for war than for love. At least war will overtake love if we feel threatened.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. So you have, obviously I think about like Maslow's hierarchy, right? And you have self-actualization and all the sort of like higher, more noble, more ethereal, orientations of life. But way down below that, you got like physiology and safety.
Yes.
And like you're saying, that the you know, that's, and I've actually read some later writings of Maslow where he said, strictly speaking, he didn't actually view it as a hierarchy. He viewed it as more like a linear, you know, parallel, sort of like cascading parallels. Be that as it may, the only way to like, let me propose something. You tell me if you agree and if it gets to kind of what you're saying, that we all want to be in a place of love within our relationships. But the only way to stay in that place is to keep our experience from getting overridden by the fear-based systems in our brain and body.
Right, which is very hard to do, easier said than done. And that's where, under the hood, a psychobiological approach is looking at the science of that, looking at development, what people can and cannot do, either because the hardware isn't there or the software isn't there. And that is what makes up you know, human beings' ability to rise above our basic primitive nature, which is Hulk smash, which is being opportunistic and selfish and self-centered, moody, fickle, and racist. That is our species. And so we have to rise above that and understand that, you know, we have to plan for our devils, not our angels, because devils we are if we are under a lot of stress, distress, or if we are not brought up well. And so so we're talking about a higher level of moral reasoning, of getting along with others by understanding the nature of being human.
So what would you describe? And normally I don't ask this question because it could be reductive, I think, in different contexts. But in this case, I think maybe it's just my bias because I've been such a beneficiary of this type of work and exploration. But so I'm going to ask, what do you see as the ultimate payoff for even for the audience to say, all right, I'm going to listen to Jeff and Stan talk for the next 45 minutes and change or whatever? What's the ultimate payoff of doing this kind of exploration and work?
The take home really is that all unions, free and fair unions of equals, that's what we're talking about in the Western world, at least, well, parts of the Western world, where the agreement is that you and I are coming together based on terms and conditions, not love, not emotion, very hard to separate those two. And that, like other unions that focus on survival, or we want to win, or we want to make money, or we want to succeed, right? We have a shared sense of mission, a shared purpose, and a shared vision of where we're going. Couples are the only union that doesn't have that. We go into love relationships not thinking at all that this is a union that has to work together toward common goals. We have to have an idea of ourselves as to why we will exist in the long run as a twosome. Why do it? What's the point, right? And so without a shared purpose, without a shared vision, all unions will fray. All unions will sort of decompensate and become dissolved, because we need that in order to get along because of our differences. We tend to focus on differences, how we're different and how we disagree, rather than how we're the same and how we and where we do agree. That's consensus. That's leadership. That's being able to find a reason for unionizing, for an alliance, right? So as soon as any union loses its sense of self, a sense of purpose, it starts to feed on itself. In other words, people will fight. There will be civil war. There will be infighting in groups. There'll be fragmentation, tribalization, and we see that happening today. That's been our nature throughout the beginning of humankind, right? And so first things first, when you are going to be in a relationship, did you organize it? You're the creators of this relationship. That's a shared mythology. It doesn't actually exist in real life. It's in our heads. Fine. That means we have to have in our heads the same ideas, or we will fight, or we will not be able to work together. We have to make sure that we have a purpose beyond and above emotion, because emotion can get us into trouble. So we have to have a purpose-centered relationship. We do this or that because it's either good, we believe, best, we believe, or the right thing to do, we believe, even though it will possibly, likely be the hardest thing to do. So that's a higher level, like I said, of moral reasoning. It's a higher level of interpersonal relationship. I have to think of you at the same time I think of me, or you'll take me as an adversary. This is a problem with all of us. So we're talking in a couple, we're talking about a two-person psychological system of we and us. And the audience need only imagine if our legs, inner legs, were bound together like a three-legged race. But if I were to do that to you and your partner, with your permission, for a month, you'd know exactly what I'm talking about. This system has to be fair and just and mutually sensitive. It has to move together, or it doesn't move anywhere. Partners have to accept each other's differences and see that as a superpower and work together cooperatively and collaboratively, or they will not go anywhere, produce anything, solve any problem. Nothing will happen except war. And that's the big idea here, that all systems that are coupled, or family or community, have to have a central organizing purpose for being, with a vision or set of visions, to get people on board, and this flattens differences. Also, we have to have rules of engagement. We have to have governance, meaning you and I can't get along unless we give each other permission to govern each other, right? To legislate what we're going to do and never do, and then also permission to enforce that. Otherwise, it's the Wild West.
So, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Keep
No,
going. I'm
that's
actually starting to take notes because it's such a
okay.
rich answer.
And number two problem, and this is physiological, this is neurobiological, is the manner in which you and I will interact when one or both of us is under stress. That is a problem because most of us will revert to a one-person system of thinking, me, my, mine, and you. And that doesn't end well, right? We're no longer allies. So we have to learn how to talk to one another and how to deal with one another in order to circumvent this survival instinct, which, like I said, is always online and always sweeping for dangerous faces or threatening voices or words and phrases or gestures, and right? All of that is happening all the time. And so we have to be smarter than the average bear here in terms of understanding the nature, again, of our mind, all the mistakes that we all are making all the time without realizing it, and learn how to get along. And that has already been invented. Long ago, it's been invented. We have things in place to keep us from murdering, raping each other. Right? And that is laws, that is principles, beliefs, that is community. That is, again, like I said, making sure that that we're existing in a society that is fair and just and mutually sensitive. That's the only thing that actually can survive the long run.
So I'm curious, as I started taking some notes. I love, first of all, I just got to say, I love this. I actually had, I don't know if this was an idea you proposed or just something I extracted, but like, I'm thinking about going home and saying to my wife, hey, I think that we should try, what if we took an entire day and tied our legs together and tried to coexist domestically for 16-hour waking interval or whatever a day is, tethered like that, and just see what it does for us, to us, from us, against us. Let's just see. Because first of all, I don't know. It's like such a powerful metaphor.
Yes.
Have you ever had people actually try to do that for any like prolonged period of, I'm picturing like trying to help each other go to the bathroom and like squat together, and
You have
I
to
mean.
squat together, you have to do everything together, which means you have to think as a two-person system, which does not dissolve the self. It is not codependency. It is interdependency. It is like people who are in the foxhole together in the military. It is like cop car partners. It is like an Olympic skating team, skating partnership. We're different. We're annoying as human beings. We're a burden as human beings. We're disappointing naturally, but we want the same thing and we have to work together with our differences. Otherwise, we don't win. And the same thing goes for a couple. We survive together in a dangerous world that has no interest in us in the long run. It's a world that is indifferent, opportunistic, and unpredictable, right? And so you and I, by social contract, agree to have each other's backs at all time. We're going to be ardent supporters of each other. We're going to protect each other in public and private. We're going to do all of these things by social contract because the world will never do that. And so we do. And therefore, the sky's the limit. If we will actually work together, we can create and solve problems really easily and quickly if we're good at it, practice, and that's power. That's power. Two people can do things that one person cannot, right? It's a mini brain.
And two people can do things that two times one person cannot.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. Like the 1 + 1 = 11, right, so to speak. Yeah.
And a lot of that has to do with the brain. A lot of that has to do with understanding how the brain works and how the brain actually doesn't work. For instance, we think that we're good communicators. Communication on any given day, I can prove this, is terrible. Terrible. We're mostly misunderstanding each other much of the time. We're just approximating each other. But all you have to do is be a teacher, an instructor, a professor, and you'll find out how many people in your audience actually got what you said. And this is happening every day. We think our memory is good, and it's terrible. We'll fight to the death over memory, which is stupid, but we believe our memory is correct, never was, never will be. And we think our perception is as is. It is reality, yes, subjectively, but that is not reality. And in reality, it's not objective, it's subjective. So, and that's changing all the time by our state of mind. Our state of mind changes our perceptions like a funhouse mirror. So we have all these errors that we make as human beings because we're very, very fancy and we can talk. And that gives us a sense that we are correct and the other person isn't. It's sort of the hubris of human beings. We have to know this because this is how we go to war. This is how we sue each other. This is how families break up. This is how kids leave and become estranged, all because of our, again, hubris, pride, misunderstanding of how our minds really work and don't work. We never can be sure, actually, if we're right. Never. If you really understood how the brain works and what happens in real time, you can't, because the brain is operating in such a way that we're not mostly conscious. We're automatic. We're moving through the day with automatic memory that we've accumulated, which allows us to be energy conserved, but it also makes us a little dumb. Because we're moving through the day not realizing that we're making errors and making all sorts of errors in our relationships. Sometimes we get away with it, sometimes we don't. Because we are handling a lot of things at once. We're not going to remember most things that are told to us, right? Like, you know, please close the door. How come you never turn off the lights? How come you do this all the time, right? Because we're automatic. We're going to do it again and again because we don't use those resources for those things. We use them for fancier things that require critical thinking, which is highly energy expending. And that's not what we do. That's not what any animal does. Nature is based on energy conservation and biology. And so we do the least amount necessary, which is why we get into trouble in love relationships, by the way.
So... yeah, it's interesting to really think of every thought, really every neurological impulse, right? So thought, feeling, reaction, what everything is basically just some sort of like heuristical estimation based on available data that's far beyond what we could rationally process in a moment. So it's like everything, we're just kind of sort of ignorantly guessing all the time at everything.
Yes, you said it, heuristic. Most of what we pick out during the day and react to is through pattern recognition, a very cheap, low-level way of figuring things out based on what we already know. And so then we make mistake on mistake. I make attribution to you, right? Based on what I know in my life, my personal narrative, and I'm getting you wrong in such a way that encroaches on your sense of self, or violates your sense of self, or feels intrusive, right? We're doing this all the time. And if only people knew, how this is working, we would be a little easier on each other and not blame each other so much and even categorize each other so much, in terms of diagnoses, right? Because there's a problem and a blessing, but there's also a problem just being human, right? It's just all you have to be is human and you're a pain in the ass.
So I'm curious if we were to, it's a little bit of context for you and the audience. I mean, my wife and I, we met in 2011. We were married in 2012. We started therapy even before we were married, and now it's 2024 and we're still going. I mean, we've been doing this 13 years. I think in our peak year, we were doing something of a therapeutic type nature, let's say, or a developmental nature for like 1,000 hours a year.
Right.
At one point, whether it was coursework, applied exercises within the coupleship, individual sessions, group sessions, sessions with kids. Like we went hard into this because out of a level of desperation. So I am processing everything you're saying through the prism of thousands and thousands of hours on the basis of a belief that what the type of thing you're talking about holds the keys to ultimately a fulfilling relationship that seems to escape most people, whether by statistics or by anecdotal evidence. Yeah. And also that there is this like holy grail out there where like it's possible to have,
yes,
this kind of relationship that is just so enriching and fulfilling. And that if people believed that, I think we would see very different tack happening in society, where like, yeah, it's almost like we've gotten sort of like cynical and fatalistic about relationships, to where even the idea of like long-term monogamy as a foundation of culture is sort of like up in the air now. I mean, it's actually kind of crazy. And I think we're all like born with this sense of what could be possible if we could solve the monogamy puzzle. And that's why we're drawn to it. So I'm curious, right, if you, yes, could speak to the zeitgeist now of like, what's the promise here? And what is it that we're missing that is having us miss that promise?
My advice always to couples is to organize, you're the architects of this. You can have any relationship you want. You can create anything you want. Forget anyone else, your parents, your culture. This is the two of you building something that fits the two of you for now. You're shaping it as you go along. This is your co-created culture. You can make it monogamous or non-monogamous. Who cares? I care that you agree on whatever that is. Mm-hmm. So one person wants monogamy, the other one wants polyamory. I don't blame either. They both have a right to live their lives the way they would like to, but they won't be able to get along, right? They won't be able to do it because they're pointing in different directions on the big ticket issues, right? Nobody can do that. So the relationship is what people say it is because it exists in their heads. Therefore, it can be anything they want, but they have to make sure that they're on the same page. They have to make sure that they actually are wanting the same thing and not doing it because they're afraid of losing the relationship lest they disagree. Because that is going to be necessary in getting along. If you and I are pointing in different directions, we won't work, right?
Can I ask you a question related to that? And it's funny, I never know where these conversations are going to go, but I'm so excited when they get there. On the monogamy question, I actually am really interested, and I try not to be just sort of like fuddy-duddy default conservative, like, oh, it's different, therefore it's bad or something. I mean, like, okay, so let's table the question of like to partner exclusively or not as like a life orientation. So I said something to my wife literally a few nights ago, laying in bed, that is the context I want to consider this question within. So what I said is, you know, I think I just had an epiphany about, you know, why a well-operated marriage feels so damn good. And what it is I had an experience earlier that day where I was talking to someone and I could tell that I was not their top priority at the time that I was talking. They had like something, you know, buzzing on their phone. It might've been their boss. It might've been their spouse. You know, someone was in their mind that was more important than me. And I suddenly realized I'm just being humored right now until they can find an escape. And so I gracefully gave it to them. And I didn't call it out. I just said, it was like, hey, by the way, I got something I got to do. I let them off the hook, so to speak. Right. And what I realized is like, you know, even the word priority, a friend of mine who used to be our CFO in my business, he once said to me, like, have you ever looked up the word priority? It means like that which comes first.
Yeah.
Even pluralizing the word priority is a misnomer. There's technically only one. Right. And so the reason I say that is like, we all have a prioritization hierarchy of relationships in our life. In other words, right now you and I are talking, but I know for a fact there's somebody that could walk into the room where you are right now and interrupt you, where immediately you would say to me, hey, Jeff, I got to go. I'm sorry. I got to deal with something. And really what you're saying is another relationship that is a higher priority than this one is now going to take over. And we all have, but then there's somebody else that could interrupt that you would escalate to and so on and so on.
I love where you're going.
Eventually we get to one person
yeah.
who is our actual priority. Yeah. And doesn't it make, and the thing that feels so dang good about a marriage, if it operates this way, is that
when it's secure functioning. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. Is that each person has agreed, you know, tacitly or otherwise, to have that one person at the top of the prioritization hierarchy be each other.
Yeah.
And like, if you're going to put somebody else at the top, it's going to feel a whole lot better if you know that they're putting you at the top.
Yep.
But that dynamic is impossible in non-monogamy. And so are there like sort of axiomatic fundamental realities of a secure attachment-based monogamous relationship that you simply cannot have in any other modality that would at least be an argument for the more traditional point of view on marriage?
It is a problem. And by the way, I wouldn't be doing anything that I do today if it weren't for my relationship with my wife. We do have shared that same feeling you're talking about, that life is awesome. No matter where Tracy and I go, it could be the worst place on the planet, but as long as I'm with her, I'm great. And she is too, because we make it that way. We decided that, we made it that way. We built it this way, right? So that just a shout out again for conscious organization. There's a biology to attachment and we seem to be herd animals that pair bond within herds. We pair bond. And that starts very, very early with the human infant. And we seem to do that again in adulthood. So the urge to pair bond is very strong, which is why there's a competing element here in polyamorous, but and also in polygamous cultures, because we tend to still pick out a primary attachment figure. That person is the person we tend to go to when we're in the most distress or we want to celebrate something. We don't go to a group, we go to a person, right? Just like when we're young, we run to the primary when we're in pain. We don't run to just anybody.
Yeah.
So it really is it can be a problem in these communities where there's ethical non-monogamy as they're moving through time. Because as we develop, we want different things. As we get older, we change, right? We get brain upgrades and we get to see the world differently, midlife an example. And we suddenly start to review our lives in 360 and go, you know, I think I need hair plugs. I think I need a BMW. I think I need to move to another country. I'm not happy in my life. I'm going to be dead soon, right? So these things change. And people will many times just go back to pair bonding in a committed relationship. But here's the thing about monogamy. I like to challenge people, you know, why be monogamous or why be not monogamous? Either way. what's your selfish reason for monogamy? Because we're not necessarily monogamous creatures, right? We're held together by nature's glue, a biology called attachment. That's not love. That is a primitive, primordial, a survival instinct. It's existential. And so we're held together to, you know, pair bond to give, to protect a child, a baby for 4 years, or to group together to protect each other from the environment, right? That's nature's glue. We're not hyenas, right? And so that is a technical problem for people who want to live that lifestyle. But still, why would you want to be monogamous? What's your selfish reason? Now, here we're getting into a value that you adhere to because you want this for yourself. It has nothing to do with your partner. That's a hard thing for people to reason around. I found a way to do it. But my feeling is that unless and until you and I can explain, defend our principles that are pro-self and pro-social, when it comes time to hold to that principle, if we don't really believe in it, we won't do it. And that's the problem here.
Are you open to, will you feel that it was an effective use of this time if we sort of like steel man and possibly straw man the monogamy argument and actually just sure. See where it takes us? Like, yeah,
I'm a musician, so riffing is, I love it.
Well, we'll have to have a separate conversation about that. I was a professional jazz musician in my 20s, and we probably have a whole other meeting we need to have. Let's stick with this monogamy question. So I love what you're saying to say, hey, like the frame that I just shared about the prioritization hierarchy.
Yeah.
If I'm the only one that matters to, then it's not it's sort of like if 1 + 1 is going to equal 3, both ones have to agree to operate in the 1 + 1 = 3 context, not the 1 + 1 = 2 context.
Right.
And it takes 2 in that sense. So the prioritization hierarchy is one sort of, you know, angle of attack where I would proffer that if two people can each put each other at the top of that hierarchy, there are going to be sort of like exponential benefits that cannot be realized any other without that dual agreement that can't be realized any other way. And I would go to the sort of generalization that like all of life only moves at the speed of trust, which is a Stephen Covey principle. It's often in business, but like the extent to which two people have even the tiniest amount of mistrust introduces friction, because now you have to take the time to be constantly verifying.
That's right.
Yeah. And so if you get to that top of the shared prioritization peak with each other, then just there's so much lubrication at the speed of trust, right? So that's one. No pun intended.
No, but I'm with you totally here.
So that's one angle. Let me offer up another one, which I'm confident you're you know deeply familiar with the work of John Gottman, one of your peers, you know, he has his love mapping principle, right? Where it's like the concept of intimacy is certainly the richness and the detail of your knowing of the other person,
right? Yes.
And give as humans who have a limited capacity for, you know, knowledge and understanding and retention, that like there's a certain sort of a finitude to my ability to map all other humans in my life in aggregate.
That's right.
And if I'm going to map my wife, so to speak, my love map with my wife is going to be like the freaking ultimate atlas of, you know, Rand McNally's most detailed atlas of a human, then I have to parse that resource if I expand it to another intimate relationship. And there's no way that 7 love maps are going to have the same level of detail as they would if you put all that energy into one. And so again, at the level of the knowing of each other, we reduce our ability if we share, frankly. So that's 2.
Yeah.
Are there any others, and or do you agree with me that there are certain ways to view the question in which monogamy is actually the only way to reach the peak? Hey there, real quick, I just wanted to let you know, I have been concentrating a lot lately on providing tons of value to my text message community. This could be
random thoughts. This could be letting you be the first to know about an event I'm planning or a special I'm running or a free training I'm hosting. Anyway, just shoot me a text to get subscribed. The number is 702-996-3926. Thanks so much. Let's get back to the podcast.
I can't because okay. I also believe in the rights of people to live their lives the way they want to, even though I choose not to. I have to, otherwise we otherize them, right? We otherize them. So I'm of the belief, again, that people consciously organize around purpose, not just because they're being pulled around by emotion, feeling, which comes and goes, right? It goes up and down. You can't live a life that way. You have to find the purpose in what you're doing. That will work over the long run. And you, all three of you or four of you believe in, and that's how you're operating. You're not operating about how you're feeling about each other from day to day, because I have to be able to do the right thing that we decided to do, even when I hate your guts. I have to do the right thing that we decided to do, even though I'm not that into you right now. A purpose-centered relationship is one that is governable and one that is safe and one that is reliable and has a higher purpose, right? It involves discipline, character, and belief in something that is greater than your own personal need at the moment, right? It's pro-self and pro-social at the same time, whether that's four or five or six people, I don't really care. So I don't have a dog in this fight because I'm personally monogamous. Mm-hmm. But I do believe what you're saying here, really important things. One, I am a fan of putting the couple first, but my reasoning around it is purpose-centered. If you and I are going to unionize and we're adults and we're deciding that we're going to be in charge of everyone and everything, right? We're in charge of our kids, we're in charge of the people that we work with, we're in charge of everybody and everything, right? We are the leaders, we're the governors, we're the generals, right? So we have to work together. That means that our relationship has to be in tip-top shape, or everyone and everything else will suffer. Kids will suffer, right? Happy parents, happy kids. When generals fight, soldiers die. When parents are fighting, kids will suffer. If a couple is not in tip-top shape, their health is being compromised, their ability to be creative, their ability to actually get anything done. They can't make anything. The factory's closed now. They can't solve any problems. They're like the current state of our Congress. They can't do anything because they're idiots. They just will not see themselves as they are. We have to be allies. We can never afford to be adversaries. That's out there. So we are unionizing for very good reasons, right? But we have to come up with them. And it can't be just involved in emotion, because we know that people do a lot of bad things in the name of love, in the name of feeling, right? So what is to keep us from doing those things? A sense of purpose and governance and fairness and justice. We're constantly making sure that you and I are okay. You and I are okay. We never play around with safety and security in such a way that I allow you even for a moment to feel insecure or unsafe. I make myself responsible for your ongoing felt sense of safety and security. Trust. You mentioned trust. Trust is everything. As soon as we don't trust each other, we cannot do anything. Everything slows down. Everything comes to a halt because how can you do business? All right? You can't. So trust is based on a lot of things. One of those things is the free flow of information. So safety and security means that if we really want to be safe and want to be adults, we have to tell each other everything. The left and right hand have to know the same thing. Otherwise, we're going to create a disaster, right? We're in charge of everything. We have to have the same information. And that makes us, again, more powerful and more free. So when you work your way down from the top, we are the most important people in this room, in any room. We are the insiders. Everybody else are the outsiders. That doesn't mean we harm people. Doesn't mean we rob people. It means we take responsibility for each other first so that we can be the best we can possibly be for everyone and everything else. That's the reason I say the couple system should be the highest priority, right? We serve the union.
So let me sort of like put some weight on what you just said. Earlier you said that coupleship is a two-person psychological system.
Right.
And the challenge is that under enough stress, and everybody has a threshold at which they will revert to
pro-self only.
To the pro-self or the survival system, which is intrinsically a one-person psychological system.
Pro-self, yeah.
Right. And so your biography, which I didn't read the whole thing, but it says that you use your work is based on a social emotional capacity model. Yes. Right. And I talk a lot, we reference Stephen Covey, his seventh habit of highly successful people is sharpening the saw. It's increasing your production capacity. I reference this a lot in both business and personal work that I do, where ultimately your limits in every area of your life, the ultimate constraint of what's possible for you in every area of your life is the capacity of your central nervous system to handle that which is unlike what has come before it.
Yes.
So like at some point you're going to be so extended out beyond your comfort zone that your nervous system is just going to freak out and you're going to like break the thing, whatever the thing is. So do you sort of agree with that basic premise? And then the social emotional capacity model, as I understand it, you're sort of defining that limit beyond which we are no longer psychically able to maintain two-person system thinking.
Actually, yes and no.
Okay.
Because if you and I see it correctly, I'm in your care. You are in my care. I take responsibility for the care and management of you. I have to be a good handler. I have to be I have to be a Jeff Whisperer, right? That goes back to your knowledge area. My life depends on knowing exactly how you work and how to work you without using a stick or a whip. That is, not using guilt, shame, or threat to get you to do what I want to do. I'm an expert and I'm learning constantly, just as I do with a baby, a child, or pet, right? I have the responsibility. Therefore, I know what to do when you're out of sorts. When you start to go nuts, I know how to take care of you. I know how to shift your state. I've learned it. I've practiced it. And I realize I have to know that for my survival, right? Again, we're going back to the fact that we are all selfish. What's the selfish reason for taking care of you? Because everything I do to you affects me. Everything. There is no way in that tied together that I can operate in a way that affects you that won't in turn affect me positively or negatively. Therefore, creating a deal where you lose is suicide for me, because there's no way I won't pay for that in a free and fair union, right? It's impossible. It'll create resentment. It'll create downstream effects. We'll be litigating this forever. Therefore, that's a stupid thing for me to do on a selfish level. But I'm also thinking in a higher level of pro-self, pro-relationship at the same time. Therefore, if we both buy into that, we are confined to a certain way of working with each other, confined, where neither of us can ever lose. That means we have to think creatively. We have to bargain. We have to negotiate, not compromise, in order to make each other whole as we go. People have done this since the beginning of time. They found that they've had to do this, right? When we know we have to do this in order to get along, in order to have a relationship that's easy, that is doesn't tie up resources, right? That allows us to take threat off the table, lowers interpersonal stress to a very small hum. We start to feel our capacity as a twosome. We start to soar together because we're not encumbered, as most people are, with the threat system, with the interpersonal stress issue, because we have learned how to work together in a way that we trust each other explicitly, implicitly, right? That we've given each other no reason to not do that. And so everything becomes smoother and easier, but we have to see it as it is. There is nothing I can do, just like being tied together, that won't affect you. If I pull against you, it'll hurt. If I go faster than you, we both fall. If we disagree, we just don't go anywhere. Do you follow? There's nothing right. And people have to get this into their heads that this is the way it works. It does not work any other way. So throw out the idea of a healthy relationship. Healthy has no meaning here. Think about what works and what can never work. And all you have to do is think about it. Think about it. Your actions and how you set up shop. Can that work? Can that work? If it doesn't work for your partner, it doesn't work.
Yeah, I wrote down in my little notes I'm taking, I wrote down what you said. If one of us loses, both of us lose.
We do. Yes. There's no way around it.
So I'm curious, you said, like you were saying, you know, roughly in relation to that, you know, what I just restated, that like, we've got to get it through our heads, right? Like we, you know, if we want marriage to be, and I like, you know, you're demoralizing it. It's not, it's just effective versus ineffective is not right or wrong or good or bad, right? Which I agree with, for the record. As much as I have strong convictions about the benefits of healthy monogamy, none of it is based on, like, you know, arbitrary morality.
Yeah.
So anyway, I wrote that if one of us loses, both of us lose. And I wrote it down because even before you said we need to get this through our head, it resonated with me as like, oh, that's a thing I need to make sure I get through my head. So I'm going to write it down.
Right.
Are there other things that you find are sort of like cracks in the foundation that people are often approaching their relationship with, that it's like, I forget exactly what you said, but it's like, you have to consider like, will this ever really work in the long run if I do it this way? One of them is the idea that I have to care about them losing as much as I care about myself losing, because if they lose, really I lose. That's one. What are some others that you may have come across in your work that everybody might benefit from hearing?
I think the matter of that I have to, okay, here's what's necessary for a secure functioning relationship. So secure functioning really means equality, fairness, justice, having the same things to gain, same things to lose. All right.
So you're not using the term secure specifically in reference to the attachment styles. You mean more broadly.
This is secure functioning refers to social contract theory.
Okay. Right? Thank you.
So these are social contracts we make with each other based on fairness and justice, but we have to be true blue in that we are on board. I cannot agree to something because you want it only. That will not work. I have to believe in it. You have to believe in it, or don't even bother, right?
These have to be mutual covenants, or else they don't exist.
Yes. And they have to be vetted actually properly. Why do you want this, Jeff? Convince me that you have a selfish need for this, because otherwise I'm not taking it, because I need to trust that you will do this when you least want to. And that will only happen if you yourself believe in it. You yourself feel that you have a personal selfish interest in this thing, right? Because we need, as animals, we need to make sure that we are protecting each other from each other, and we are pointing in the same direction. You cannot bullshit around this, right? Because our lives are at stake, our happiness is at stake. So this is a real thing, complicated by people being afraid that if they say what they want or they disagree, they will lose the gig. And that's the attachment system that's making them stick together, even though they shouldn't be together, right? This is a problem, a problem of biology, but also a problem of maturity. So what does it take in order to be in this kind of relationship you and I are talking about? I have to be able to tolerate pain, full stop. If I can't tolerate pain, and I've led a life of conflict avoidance and avoiding pain, I cannot get along in this way. I cannot be on a team of this kind. I have to be able to accept my losses and know my losses and be able to grieve them. Otherwise, I will be acting quite strangely, and I will want you to behave like me, avoid loss. And also, people who can't grieve tend to be very angry people. I have to be able to accept differences as they are, and that you are different from me. You are not me. You are not. You will never be me. I can influence you. You'll influence me, but I can't actually be you, right?
So it's like, I have to accept not just the differences, but the irreconcilability of the differences.
Yeah, the fact is that you have a different brain, a different background. You have you're predetermined by generations of culture. You're predetermined by your genetics, predetermined by the way you're raised, you're predetermined by your experiences. You know, all of these things. You've lived on the planet as long as I have. So we have to come to where we can find agreement.
Yeah.
Consciously, we can't just assume anything. So I have to accept differences and be able to work with them. Or I will not be able to work with you. I won't. I have to be able to hold impulses. Because if I can't hold to an agreement that we've made, you know, I can forget, but I've given you permission to remind me. When reminded, I have to cooperate. If I don't and cannot cooperate, I can't be on the team. I cannot do that because nobody can trust me. I could come in the middle of the night and hurt you. Because I can't control my impulses, or I will not be governed by you, right? So this is an adult, grown-up thing of accepting disappointment, accepting all people are disappointing, that we're different, and I have to know you. I have to know how to operate you. Why? Because as human beings, we do not like that which we cannot operate, we cannot control. A baby that cries and has GERD perhaps or colicky, but I can't settle my baby. I don't like the baby. I don't like the baby because I can't settle the baby, which can't settle me. And therefore I feel incompetent, right? The baby is not within my control. I don't like the car that I can't drive. I don't like it. It's too complicated. I don't like the computer. I don't get it, you know, right? So we have to understand that it's a duty. It's part of the career. I have to know you and operate you. Otherwise, I'll be incompetent. I'll hurt you. And you will not feel that you're with someone who understands and can actually handle you. Going back to childhood, just as it might have been in childhood with parents, we have a duty. I have to know you. We are not family. We are not family. We are strangers forever. Trying to get to know each other, and that's part of the excitement. That's part of the gig. Yeah.
Can I raise my hand? this is so rich. I'm taking these notes. I'm like, I'm literally going to go home and talk to my wife about these essentially these agreements, these covenants that must be mutual and reliable in the sense that we vetted them. They're not just words. Right. And this last one that you're talking about, which is you're talking about, we need to be able to sort of call it work the other person. We have to know how to meet their needs in a way that stabilizes the relationship so we get our own needs met. Like you were talking about, and we've seen this, when a mother cannot console their baby, it almost breeds enmity towards the baby because it's like, I can't work this person. And so I'm wondering,
this is why we want to intervene at that point. It's not the mother's fault. This is a human thing.
Yeah. But I'm wondering, is the covenant within the relationship that's, because I feel like there's this resistance sometimes to like, well, I don't want the other person to be able to manipulate me. It's almost like a defensive, like, I'm not going to let them know where my levers and my buttons and my gears are, because I don't want them to be able to work me. But in a sense, aren't we talking about trusting each other enough to let them know how our own machinery works and trust them to use that knowledge for good, not harm?
Yes. Yes.
And so the covenant is like, I agree to allow myself to be known in such a way that you can work me, because we have to be able to work each other for the long-term good of the relationship.
And we can't survive without that. Imagine you're in the foxhole with somebody who's very anxious and fearful. You better know how to handle that person. Otherwise you're toast, right? You can't beat it.
I wonder how many people sort of, because of trust, I mean, fundamentally it's about trust, which I don't know if you subscribe to the psychosocial development stages theory, but like that's the very first one, right? Trust versus mistrust is our conflict, you know, of our first 2 years of life. And so at deep down, if there aren't people who have this like fundamentally embedded trust issue from something that they don't even remember when it wasn't resolved, and therefore they're defending themselves in their relationship from being able to be worked, which could ultimately end up being the reason that it's like, you know, dead man walking in the first place.
Yes. So here's an example. I'm not a very easy person. I'm just not, you know, interpersonally. I'm a nice guy, but you know, I can be selfish and self-centered and moody and irritable. My wife knows exactly how to handle me. And if I get obsessive and I can't let go of something, she knows exactly what to do. And I know what she's doing. When she's doing it, she'll distract me. And because of cooperation, I know she's doing, we have agreements, I will cooperate and go along with the distraction, right? Because I know she's getting me out of something that isn't actually good for me. It's not good for us. And so so we are each other's handlers. We've become very good at it, and it's much appreciated because you know me. You know how to do it. You know, and it makes me feel that I'm with somebody I can depend on, right? I'm with somebody who understands. She's with somebody who understands. That is what we're talking about. We're not talking about being manipulated for one's own good at your cost. We're talking about a kind of manipulation that's pro-social. That is a way of understanding how to shift your state as needed. Again, think of the two-legged race. I have to know how to work with you or we lose. You have to know how to work with me if something happens. You know this is going to happen. You've predicted me. This is how we win. You have to understand it's a necessary condition, and it's friendly, and it is what we would hope our childhood was like.
Right.
Parents that studied us, that knew us, that didn't misappraise us, right, and were interested. So we're talking about, really, we're talking about attention. Attention and presence and interest in each other. Interest. And that's something we have to do because of the automatic brain. The automatic brain tells us, I already know you. I don't. I think I know you. And so I go on to other novelty things, but now you bore me because I don't pay attention. I don't notice the novelty in the ordinary. We have to actively work against that. We have to actively work against our tendency to think we know, to think that that our partner is family, they're not, to think that they are still a stranger. That is very, very interesting if only we look, if only we actually pay attention. I don't know if you know, but we store an image of our partner's face for weeks, maybe months, without ever looking, right? We don't even look. I just know what your face looks like. But when we do love, you go, oh my God, you're so interesting.
right. Well, so, okay, Dr. Tackin, I knew this was going to happen. We're literally out of time. I feel like we just wrote a nice introduction to what could be a great conversational book. I would love, if you're open to it and we could talk off the air, I'd love to, if you'd be willing to come back. I will say for the audience's benefit, I tried to distill as Dr. Tackin was talking, essentially these covenants or these agreements, and I'll share that in the show notes, but man, I have so many questions right now. I just don't think I'm going to be sated unless we can have a part two. But in the interest of time for now, could you share with the world who I'm sure those listening are as eager as I am for more of this, how can they go get more from you and of you? Where can they go find you?
At thepactinstitute.com, that's the P-A-C-T, institute.com. We train therapists, mental health professionals all over the world. That's how this started, actually. And we also do a couple workshops online, my wife and I, my partner. And we also are going to be doing a Portugal trip, a very fancy one in Portugal, 8 days. You can find that also at the Pact Institute. So my books, there are 9 of them, and some are audio only. Wired for Love, which was the first popular book, has been updated to the second edition, and is just, you know, I'm smarter now than I was then. It's all, I look back and I go, oh, you said that? That's not right.
Oh yeah, I've only written one full-length book, and I already feel the same. It's I don't know if I'm ever gonna write another book or if I'm just gonna keep updating the one book, but I feel the pain. So just to be clear, the PACT Institute, which I believe PACT stood for psychobiological approach to couples therapy, but it's not just a resource for clinicians. It's
No.
Anybody that wants to be better in that part of their life can get something there.
And it's not really just for couples either. It can be adopted for business. It can be adopted for families. By the way, one of my favorite books from Covey was the family mission statement.
Oh, yeah. I love that work. I mean, work around what one of our sort of operating principles at in my work, my company Entre, is to run your life more like a business and run your business more like a human life. Like, humanize your business, optimize your life, in that sense. And yeah, taking what are often corporate theory, management theories, and applying them to the domestic corporation, really powerful. Okay. Thank you. We've got to wrap. Dr. Tatkin, yes, thank you. You've been an incredible guest. Like I said, I'm going to just speak this into the universe. We're having Dr. Tatkin back, whatever arm twisting it so requires.
And I can tell you, jazz musician, just how we played.
So. Yeah. Well riff. Okay. And of course, to all you viewers and listeners out there, even when Dr. Tatkin's on, you're still the best part of this show. So grateful we got to spend this time together, and I cannot wait for the next one. Take care.
Hey, it's Jeff here. If you liked this episode of Unlock Your Potential, it would mean so much if you would like and share the episode on whatever platform you're listening or viewing on. And if you really like what we're doing here and you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review. There is so much work that goes into these episodes, and you leaving a positive review lets us know that that work is reaching people, and especially it helps us reach other people. Your review could be the reason that someone else decides to tune in, check out this podcast, and unlock their potential and ultimately level up the quality of their life. So thank you so much for your support and for listening, especially if you like or share or leave a review. Thank you for helping us spread the word, and thank you for unlocking your potential to go make the world and your world a better place.